Good morning. Time now for the news of the world. For our first report, we take you from the newsroom in San Francisco to our reporters at United Nations headquarters in far-off Australia. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Martin Ogrodzki with the Allied Forces in Australia. A few minutes ago, I was informed at GHQ that no official information was available indicating that the naval and air battle off the northeast coast of Australia has been renewed. The only new official information available was issued 2.5 hours ago and refers to the Jap claims of heavy damage to our fleet. It reads, I quote, "The enemy version of the battling off the northeast coast of Australia is entirely fictional and has no semblance of a true communique of fact. It must be regarded in the light of propaganda rather than as a military report. His claims of damage inflicted on our naval forces are fantastic. Our losses, compared with his own, were relatively light. The only reason they are not published at the present time is because it revealed to him information of value." Unquote. Here is as much of the battle picture as it's harmless to release. The battle which may be going on this minute in the tropic seas off northeast Australia is the culminating point of what the communique described as a major Jap effort begun 6 weeks ago to, I quote, "extend aggressive conquests towards the south and southeast," unquote. The phrase of the south must mean the island continents of Australia and New Zealand. To the southeast must mean the chain of Allied Pacific Island bases which 6 weeks ago began at Tulagi on the extreme southern tip of the Solomon Islands, then extended through the New Hebrides and the Fiji Island group, and culminated in the American-defended island of New Caledonia. These, then, were the twin Jap objectives. For the attack on Australia, the Jap began 6 weeks ago to attempt to expand his air bases in the immediate vicinity of this continent, that is, in New Guinea and New Britain. New types of long-range bombers and new improved types of the famous Jap Zero fighters were flown into these adjacent bases to accomplish this expansion. At the same time, troop transports with naval covering forces were gathered in the Caroline and Solomon Islands to the north. The size of these concentrations is revealed by our reconnaissance to be so large, it was assumed one portion of this naval force might attempt to descend on our New Guinea base of Port Moresby and the continent of Australia itself, while the other might operate independently for an attack on our Pacific Island bases to the southeast. This, in fact, is what happened. The sequence was this. Instead of waiting for these Jap forces to take the initiative, we decided to hit them before they were on the move. Throughout the entire 6-week Jap aerial development period in New Guinea and New Britain, our bombers hit hard, dislocating, and I quote the communique, "the Jap plans through the destruction of installations and aircraft," unquote. Then, while maintaining a land-based air attack to neutralize the Jap invasion preparations in New Guinea, our Pacific Fleet went up north to the Solomon Islands and on Monday began the job of breaking up the Jap plans for an amphibious attack with one force against Australia, with the other against our Pacific Island supply line to the United States. Our attack, begun in the Solomon Islands, did not quite get to the Jap before he was on the move. What happened was that we successfully intercepted his invasion fleet already en route to the attack. Since Monday, the battle has moved steadily south and southeast. So yesterday was in progress in the Coral Sea, directly off the southeast tip of New Guinea. That's the basic picture. To it, I can add one more point. That is that the air arm again proved its overwhelming strength in present-day naval battle. The official GHQ spokesman today did not qualify our undoubted advantage in the first stages of the battle as a decisive victory. The best he would say was that he was satisfied the first round was ours. Before you break out the victory flags at home, remember first, we don't know yet our own losses, and second, the Japs wanted to move south and southeast, and since Monday, they have moved steadily in that direction. This is Martin Ogrodzki returning now to San Francisco.
Now, for the news headlines from other far-flung battlefronts, we take you to the newsroom in New York.
We take you across the Atlantic now for news of Great Britain as reported by John McVane.
This is London. A powerful force of British bombers last night attacked the German Baltic port of Warnemünde, 7 or 8 miles from Rostock. This town has a U-boat training base and an important aircraft factory. There's a train ferry to Denmark in Warnemünde, which the Germans use for troops and supplies to Norway. Enemy aerodromes were also attacked, and 19 British planes are missing. Coastal command planes flew up the fjord at Haugesund, Norway, and attacked and set afire a large ship at anchor. A couple of German bombers were destroyed in a raid on an English east coast town last night, and 2 Messerschmitts were destroyed over the southwest coast this morning. London heard today from New Delhi that Japanese planes caused slight damage and some casualties when they bombed and machine gunned the port of Chittagong, India, yesterday. Chittagong, 220 miles east of Calcutta, has been raided again today, but we haven't any details yet. The Admiralty announced today that the little British naval trawler Horatio fought a winning battle against 6 Messerschmitts. The trawler shot one down, badly damaged a second, and drove off the other 4. From all the bombing and machine gunning, the trawler suffered only superficial damage and no casualties. The government candidate has been elected in the Putney by-election to Parliament. The independent, accused of defeatism by Mr. Churchill, got only about a quarter of the total votes. In the last few days, the British people have begun to hear more than ever before about post-war conditions and the improvement of the social system. The new Archbishops of Canterbury and York started off with speeches indicating that the church was behind measures that would give a fairer deal to the working man and his family after the war. Yesterday, the Bishop of Bradford warned that wartime controls have been put on the individualist system of private capitalism. He said that after the war, people will ask why these controls needed to win the war shouldn't be retained to make a better going concern of the peace. Last night, Mr. Anthony Eden, British Foreign Minister, gave what are presumably the government's views on post-war Britain. He asserted the world has shrunk so much that there's no room for isolation, selfish or unneighborly policies. He said there'll be but one village street from Edinburgh to Chungking. Mr. Eden declared that peace isn't possible without social improvement. If there are 3 million unemployed here and countless millions of unemployed in Europe, America, and Asia, you will not get peace. While Mr. Eden was speaking of peace, Sir Archibald Sinclair, the Air Minister, was talking of war. He declared the RAF is going to continue and increase its destruction of Germany's industrial Ruhr and Rhineland. He predicted a terrible summer for the German Air Force and said its squadrons would be attacked by day and night, in the air and on the ground. He said, this is the Battle of Britain the other way around. And he significantly noted that when the German Air Force is hammered out of shape, British forces will invade the continent of Europe. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
And now we're going to have a report from Northern Europe. Go ahead, Stockholm.
Hello, New York. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. The Germans have now made one of the most astounding admissions which has ever come out of the Axis countries. It comes in the form of an article written by the German military expert, Major Otto Mossdorf. In this article, the author claims that the German forces have not yet come up against the main Russian army, and if they have, it has only been on a minor scale. Here is the major's thesis. In the event of a war, the Russians had counted upon losing countless numbers of soldiers and material. With that in mind, they placed reserves or second-line troops as a ring around their main elite troops. In other words, the Germans have been fighting the second-line Russian forces up to now, and the troops stationed within this ring, the elite troops, have been spared actual combat. The major further claims that the Germans have succeeded in breaking down this outer ring, or at least had done so by the outset of winter, so that when they begin their new spring or summer offensive, they will be able to take a crack at the Russian elite troops. How strange this line of reasoning must sound to one who's followed the German propaganda during the course of the winter. To judge from all their previous claims, it would seem that the Germans had already broken the resistance of the main Russian army, and that all remains would be for them to go on in and clean up. Even as far back as 9 months ago, when I was in Germany, the people were only counting the days until the German Wehrmacht would announce the final annihilation of the Russian army. And if you followed the development of German propaganda during the course of the winter, what do you find to be its paramount thesis? If it could be transferred into one word, I think it would be backtracking. When the Germans retired to so-called winter quarters, they blamed the weather. When they later withdrew, quote, to straighten out their lines, unquote, they blamed Russian partisans as one of the reasons. When they continued to fall back, or at least showed no progress, they once again blamed the thaw. And now what do we find? The Germans are even building up an alibi for further setbacks in the Russian front. The alibi being that they haven't yet encountered the main Russian army. So maybe Hitler had his reasons for speaking of another winter war. It only remains to be seen what he will invent for future alibis. This is David Anderson returning it out of New York.
Events at home are reported next by Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. Dave Anderson's report seems to harmonize or tune in not with the facts or the propaganda, but with the considerable optimism expressed this past few days about ending the war this summer or this year at the latest. And I think I could try to point out from Washington sources that the government doesn't plan it that way at all. Maybe they would if they could, but we haven't the power yet. Vice President Wallace, speaking in New York last night, tipped off the nation to the facts we face. One's a possible invasion of Alaska, and two, a German-led uprising in South America somewhere. This summer, he warned, will be a serious and critical time as Hitler gathers up his final strength for a final blow. We are going to defend, not attack, in 1942, I think. Let me sketch the thing from a military standpoint as it is looked on here. Hitler has 9 million armed, trained men. We are still working with a basic 1.5 million, spread around a good bit. Plane, tank, and other protection is good and getting better, but as in the case of planes, they seem to come off the line faster than we can train pilots. But when we catch up, it'll be good night, Hitler. Hitler this summer must smash Russia or be smashed. Hence that interesting alibi reported by David Anderson. Hitler sees two places in North Russia where supplies come pouring in, Murmansk and Archangel. He will try and will continue to try to close those ports. He may attack that upper section from Norway through Sweden. And then there in the south, there's the Caspian Sea, and across that sea flows constant supplies, oil, up the Volga. Germany is low on oil, dips into her reserves now. Military men feel that Germany's strategy down in that part of the world now contains a grab for much-needed Mideast oil. Now look on the map of Asia and see Manchukuo. See also how in Siberia, right next door to Manchukuo, is the Russian port of Vladivostok, pointing like a pistol across the Sea of Japan at Tokyo. From a military man's viewpoint in Washington, it is most likely that someday Japan will dash right straight across Siberia, attacking Russia, and knock out Vladivostok, or try it. Unless Russia does something about attacking Japan first and protecting Vladivostok. Japan knows that if Germany fails, all the United Nations will turn on Japan, and Japan knows the same thing. All of these jackals that trail along know the same thing. We learn here in Washington that Laval is gyrating to that low point where he wants to supplant Mussolini, the threat that no one remembers, in the clammy affections of Adolf Hitler. Evidently, he wants to be a chum with scum. Domestic news includes the fact that Ways and Means Committee of the House apparently will not scare everybody with the Treasury proposals of bigger slices from your income by reducing the family exemption. If the bill doesn't raise enough money, it is quite possible that the Ways and Means Committee will recommend a general sales tax. And that's all from Washington at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Godwin. Well, folks, you've been listening to our regular early morning roundup of On the Spot World News. Your reporters were Martin Nagransky from Australia, John McVane from London, David Anderson from Stockholm, and Earl Godwin from Washington. For the latest news, well, we suggest that you keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.